Usha, Sufis, the People of the Path, Volume 2. Talks on Sufism, given at the Osho Commune International, Pune, India. Discourse number 14.
The first question. You say there is nowhere to go. To go somewhere is to perpetuate the illusion, and sometimes I see it. And you say religiousness is to reject the known, and one should not stand on the crossroads but dare and commit mistakes. You say it is already the case, the seeker is the sought, and you say religion is self-creation, constant rebellion. The combination and the harmony of all these things between them is singly messy. That's true. Have you ever witnessed a childbirth? It is messy, singly messy. This is birth of a new consciousness. You are witnessing something rare. It happens only once in thousands of years. Whenever something new is born, it is messy. You can ask the scientists what they say about the birth of the world. It was utterly messy. It was chaos. The cosmos has come out of a chaos. And before I can create you, I have to destroy you. I have to dismantle the old completely. Naturally, when the old is dismantled and the new has not yet been created, there is a period, a transition period, where everything will be messy. But if the chaos is going to give birth to a star, it has to be welcomed. Order system is not always good, is not always beneficial. Disorder is not always harmful. One has to look into each case to determine it. It depends. If destruction is the goal, then destruction is violence. It is ugly. If creation is the goal, then who has been able ever to create anything without destruction? You have to be destroyed. And that's my device, to give you contradictory statements. That is my design. It is a Naqshbandi. I contradict you so much. I contradict myself so much for a certain reason. If you go on listening to me, sooner or later, you will start believing. That's the whole purpose. Because you will know it is meaningless to believe this man. Tomorrow he will contradict. Before you are established in a belief, he will contradict it. He will not leave you settled in any shelter. Once you know this, slowly, slowly the old habit of the mind to cling to a certain concept disappears. It can disappear only if you are continuously contradicted. If I am very consistent, I will become your belief. I will become your church. I will become your religion. And I don't want to become your church or your dogma or your religion. I want to become your salvation, your liberation, your freedom. The goal is so utterly different. You may be seeking a kind of belief, then you are in trouble. That is why Anand Veda is in trouble, who has asked this question. He must be seeking some security in some idea. He wants some idea to cling to. He wants a shelter to hide himself behind it. He does not want to face the messy life as it is. He wants to prepare. He wants to go prepared to meet life with ideas, ideologies, concepts, philosophies. He wants to go to see God with fully ready-made minds. Otherwise, God is messy. It is utter chaos. To meet God unprepared is to disappear in Him. But that is the only meeting. There is no other. If you are not ready to disappear into that chaos, you will not meet God. God is not a concept, but you want concepts. You want a clear-cut philosophy. So you can depend on it. And you can fight in the name of that philosophy. You can argue in the name of that philosophy. Now it will be very difficult to argue for me. It is impossible to argue for me. You cannot. Anybody can see that my statements are contradictory. No great insight is needed to see that. Any stupid person can see that my statements are contradictory. Intelligence will be needed to see that my statements are not about truth. They are devices, designs, to distort something in your mind. Great intelligence will be needed to see that. I would not allow you ever to settle with me. You will have to move. Every day I will create and every day I will destroy. Sooner or later, the understanding will dawn on you that there is no need to cling. Because you cling and then it is taken away again, it hurts. So why cling in the first place? Unclinging is freedom. These contradictory statements are not meant as statements about truth. No, not at all. Truth cannot be said. Nobody has ever said it. Nobody will ever say it. It is not possible. Truth cannot be confined to the word. And I am not saying truth. I am simply creating a space in you. The space I call unclinging. Unattached mind. Contentless mind. Once that state is there, you will know what truth is. I cannot say what truth is, but I can create a device, a design in you, in which you will be able to see the truth. When you listen to me, you listen as if you are listening to a philosopher, then you will miss me. You listen to me as if you are listening to a theologian, then you will miss me. You listen to me as if I am a logician, then you will miss me. Logic I use only to destroy logic. Words I use only to destroy words. Scriptures I use only to destroy scriptures. the more silently, intelligently you will listen to me, this fact will become slowly, slowly very, very clear to you. In that clarity, there is vision. In that transparency, in that silence, when not a single idea is there in your mind about truth, truth comes in. So these statements are contradictory. Contradiction and paradox is my design. And I am not saying to you, do this or do that. That's how again you create trouble for yourself. You listen to me with a deep desire to do something. So when you listen something that I am saying, do this, or you interpret as if I am saying do this, you catch hold of it immediately. You start preparing how to do it, and the next moment I say that is wrong, then you are at a loss. You were just ready to jump into act, and before you have even acted, it is no more right. I'm trying to help you drop all kinds of desires. This desire too, that you have to attain to truth, that you have to attain to nirvana. This desire too, that you have to be desireless. Why you are in such a hurry to do something? Why can't you be, simply be? Being is sanity and salvation. The moment you start doing, you get into confusion. Because whatsoever you do, and I am saying unconditionally, whatsoever, it will create more ego in you. Doing creates the doer. And ego is the whole problem. The ego has to be dropped. And the ego always waits for the opportunity to do something. When I am trying to explain to you what meditation is, I am doing one thing, you are preparing for something else. I am trying to say to you, I am simply sharing my insight into meditation, my experience into meditation. I am trying just one thing, to make you alert what this state of meditation is. While I am talking about the state, you are planning inside how to attain it, what to do about it. You exist in a totally different dimension. I say meditation cannot be done. One can be in meditation, but one cannot do it. It is just like love. You can be in love, but what can you do about it? Either it is or it is not. Listening to me, you go on interpreting, reducing everything that I say into how to do it. I'm saying to you that if you can simply listen to me, that will bring enlightenment. There is no need to do anything else. Just by hearing it, just by seeing what is transpiring here between me and you, just by being with me, you will become enlightened not by doing anything. But that you don't like very much, because that does not give you the ego. If enlightenment happens just by being with me, then who are you? Then what are you? Then what you have done? Then how can you brag about it? it will be a gift. You will have to be thankful for it. You will have to be grateful for it. You cannot go into the world saying that I have done it. How can you say I have done it? It has nothing to do with your doing, are you? No, you are not much interested in that. You are interested in doing it, in achieving it, attaining it, so that you can say that you have attained it. But how can you attain enlightenment? You are the barrier to it, the only barrier. Enlightenment comes when you are not. It is available right now. It is all around. Enlightenment is the stuff the existence is made of. It is showering in the sun rays. It is singing in the birds. It is dancing in the trees. It is in me. It is in you. Just you have to come to a point where you are not doing anything. And suddenly you see the fact of it. The radiant presence of it. But it happens only when you are not in a moment of doing. Doing, you become concerned. Doing, you go outward. Non-doing, you are suddenly inside yourself. Doing is the way to go outside yourself. Non-doing is the way to be where you should be. To be where you really are. Doing takes you into the future, in time. Non-doing allows you to relax into eternity. Paradox is my way, so that you will never be able to cling to anything I say. And you will be grateful one day that I was not consistent. Because with a consistent man, you can be never in that dimension called enlightenment. With a consistent man, you will become a follower. With the consistent man, you will become very logical, philosophical. You will have beautiful ideas to propound to the world. You will have a good, established, systematic mind. But that has nothing to do with enlightenment. You can become enlightened only with an utterly inconsistent man. And when you will be able to see what I am doing here, then you will be surprised that all my statements are inconsistent, and yet there is a consistency in my being. And that consistency is that I am continuously paradoxical, consistently paradoxical, consistently inconsistent. That consistency one day you will see. On the surface, I will say many things, and each thing will be against other things, and you will not be allowed to possess any idea. I am here to take all ideas from you, not to give you more ideas. As it is, you have already more than enough. The second question, the theory that we have to push, force and kick ourselves. Is this true? I hate fighting myself. Look at the question. I go on saying to you that truth is not somewhere else. It is here. You have not to struggle your way towards it. It is through the struggle that you are missing it. You are not to push the river. By pushing the river, you will never reach anywhere. You will simply get tired and exhausted. By pushing the river, you are creating only a possibility of your utter failure. You cannot fight with the river. The river is huge, life's river. The river of existence is so huge and you are so tiny. You are just a ripple in the ocean. The ripple trying to fight with the ocean, trying to direct the ocean, trying to achieve a private goal. It is simply ridiculous. And all struggle makes you ridiculous. And all struggle makes you tired, exhausted, dull, sad, miserable. But one thing is there in the struggle. That thing is that you feel you are. The ego feels very good. You are fighting. You are giving a good fight. Maybe you cannot win, but nobody can say that you were a coward. Nobody can say that you didn't give a good fight. Maybe you cannot win, or who knows, maybe you can win. The mind goes on thinking in those ways. Maybe others have not won, but you may be exception. What others have not done, maybe it is left for you to do. Give a good try. The ego will feel good. You are doing something. Bigger the fight, the bigger the ego. The more you push the river, the more you feel you are. Against the river, you feel I am. The feeling of I am always comes when you are against something. The more you fight and protest, the more you struggle, the more you will feel you are defined, well defined. Take the other as the enemy and he becomes your definition. Take the other as the friend and your boundaries are no more clear cut. When you are sitting by the side of your friend or your beloved, the boundaries are not clear. They are overlapping. You are overflowing into each other. You don't know where you end and where your friend begins. And if the friendship is really deep, something immensely beautiful happens. Egos disappear. There is an Indian myth. To understand the myth, you will have to understand these three words. First, the myth. The myth is, it is the myth of the creation. It is far more beautiful than any other myth of creation. Hindus say, he was alone. He means God. He was alone. But not really alone. Because he was two in one. He was man and woman together. He was in a deep loving embrace. But he was also one. Because there was no boundary. It was not possible to say where he ends and where his beloved begins. The man and the woman were almost one in a cosmic embrace, ecstatically lost into each other. Eternity passed. And he started feeling alone. Naturally, when you don't have a definition, then it doesn't matter whether you feel like being alone. He started feeling alone. The aloneness became too heavy, and then he decided to separate. So he fell in two parts. The Sanskrit word for falling apart is pat. Pat means falling apart, to fall. From pat comes the Hindi word patan. Patan means fall. He fell in two. And because of the word pat, the husband in India is called pati and the wife is called patni. They fell in two parts. One part became pati, husband. Another part became patni, wife. The word pati and patni are derived from pat. They fell in two. And since then, the myth says, they are trying to reach each other again. Because now they are feeling very much separated and divorced. Hence, the desire for love, the immense desire for love, the search for the others, to find someone with whom you can be one again. When you are together with a beloved one, you lose identities. You cannot feel who you are. Because the other is involved, intimately involved in your being. In love, ego disappears. When you hate, when you fight, when you struggle, ego arises. When you are sitting with your enemy, you are perfectly well defined because you are not overflowing, he is not overflowing, you don't meet anywhere, there is distance. So the whole thing is, when you struggle, it is not for truth. When you struggle, it is not for nirvana, enlightenment. When you struggle, the deep urge is to declare yourself that I am powerful, that I am against the world, against existence. But then there is trouble also. Once you declare I am, there arises a great fear that if I am, then there is every possibility one day I may not be. You have to understand this. This is one of the basic fundamental problems each intelligent person has to face. First you try to declare I am, and you feel very good that I am somebody, someone is special. So whole life you try to become special, extraordinary in some way or other, become a famous painter or a poet or a politician, have more money than anybody else has, make a palace to live so everybody feels jealous. In some way, prove that you are special, you are not ordinary rat. You are not of the crowd, you are above the crowd. Or become an ascetic, renounce the world. Or stand on your head and become a yogi. But do something so that the whole world comes to know that you are not ordinary, you are special. People do so many things so different to each other, but the motive is the same. If you go deeper, you will find the same motive. They want to declare to the world, I am. But then arises the problem. First, you have to struggle to prove that you are. Once you have proved, anxiety comes in. Anxiety that if you are, you can disappear too. Anything that is going towards annihilation. The tree was there yesterday, now it is gone. The flower was there morning, evening it is gone and withered away. The child was alive, and now the child is dead. You see everywhere, birth is continuously followed by death. Existence is surrounded by non-existence. Life seems to be always provoking death. They seem to be parallel. Once you have defined yourself clearly that I am this, once you have become this, suddenly a great trembling arises in your being that you can disappear, that you will die. Now, again misery settles in. First, you create the ego, then the fear comes, the ego will disappear. If you don't create the ego, there is no fear of death, not possible at all. Because if you are not, how can you die? If you are not, then there is no death. Death is always of the ego. Once ego is not there, how can you die? Just the other night I was reading a case, a very strange case. A child was born in Philadelphia. It was a premature birth. It was a miscarriage. But it was a rare phenomenon. The child was alive. It should not be alive according to medical science. It was only 0.5 pounds. But alive. Now the difficulty was that medical science says you cannot call a child born below 1 pound alive, because never it happens. At least 1 pound is a must. Even the 1 pound child is not going to live, but he can be alive for a few days or few moments. But this child was not even 1 pound. So the doctor could not give him a certificate of birth. But the child was alive. And the child lived for 2 days. 48 hours the child lived. No birth certificate was issued. And then the child died. Now, no death certificate can be issued, because when the child was never born, how can you certify that he is dead? But up to now, things were simple. But then they demanded for 48 hours care and medicine and this and that, money from the parents. They said, but when the child was never born and never died, about whom you are talking? What are you talking about? 48 hours, you say you cared, but whom you cared? Now, it was such a complicated case that the hospital authorities has to keep quiet. Mom, they didn't go to the court because they will be, it will not be possible for them. First, the child should be given a birth certificate, then the death certificate, then those 48 hours care is possible. Death is possible only if ego is born. If ego is not there, there cannot be any death. Then life is eternal. Then life has a different quality to it, of eternity, of immortality. The ego wants to be immortal. That is not possible. You are immortal. But the ego cannot be immortal. The ego will have to die, not one, but 1001 deaths. And ego is very, very vulnerable, very delicate. Somebody insults and there is a death, a small death. Your business goes bankrupt and there is a small debt. Something goes wrong, a small thing, and there is a debt. It's small things, and you will die many times. The ego is always ready to die because it is a false artifact. It is a pseudo phenomenon. And to keep it alive, you will have to keep pushing the river. So first, conflict, struggle, violence, aggression, they are needed for the ego to exist. They are the fuels, the food for it. But they create misery. And the greater misery comes when ego has been created, a fear arises, the fear of death. So the egoist simply suffers. The non-ego state is the state of celebration. You ask me, the theory that we have to push, force and kick ourselves, is this true? That's what I have been telling you, that it is the most dangerous calamity that has happened to humanity. The idea to force, kick, push, to fight, that is the most dangerous idea that has poisoned humanity. But if you want to have an ego, that is the only way. You will have to drink the poison. And only you will be suffering and suffering, and you will remain in a hell. But you will have one good feeling that I am. Judge Bernard Shaw is reported to have said, somebody asked him when he was dying, where would you like to go, to heaven or hell? He said, that depends. If I can be first in the heaven, then I will go to heaven. But I have to be number first. If that is not possible, because others have reached before Jesus and Buddha and etc. And if they have already occupied important positions, they are sitting by the side of God already, then I would like to go to hell. But I want to be first anyway, anywhere. Even hell is okay. He was joking against the whole human mind. What he was saying is true. You ask deepest in your mind, where would you like? In hell, if you can be made a king there, or in heaven, if you have to be a servant there. And you will be surprised. You agree with Banaksha. Your mind will say what you will do. Just being a servant, forget all about it. Hell is far better. You will be the king. Of course, you will suffer, but it is worth. Kings suffer, but it is worth. Politicians suffer, but it is worth. Rich people suffer, but it is worth. Poor people may not suffer that much. They don't suffer. They cannot afford that much suffering. That much suffering is possible only when you can afford it. Nobody's don't suffer much. There is nothing to suffer. You cannot humiliate them. They are already standing at the last. You cannot throw them further back. Beggars don't suffer that much. Now, can a beggar suffer as much as Richard Nixon? It is impossible. Where can you throw a beggar? He is already there where you can throw him. He cannot suffer. But he is a beggar. Nobody. That is like a knife in the heart. Continuously that I am nobody. The beggar also wants to be somebody. Even if it comes through suffering, it's okay. One has to look into this dangerous mind, that the mind wants to have an ego even though hell is created in getting it. Mind is not ready to be happy and sane and blissful if ego has to be lost. And you all go on doing the same. I watch you doing it every day. For a small things you are ready to drop your blissfulness, but you cannot drop your ego. And you are ready to suffer as much as possible, as you can tolerate, if it helps the ego. Beware of it. I am not saying to you to force your way. There is no need. You relax. You let go. You start floating with the stream. Not even swimming is needed. You simply let the stream take you. It will take you to the ocean. It is already going to the ocean. You need not push. Push is needed when you start trying going upstream. When you start going against nature, then push, conflict, struggle is needed. When you are going according to nature, there is no need to struggle. Nature is already going that way. You relax with it. And then there is a great song in the heart. Because all misery disappears. But with misery, you also disappear. You cannot have both yourself and bliss. That is not possible. That is not possible because the nature does not function that way. You will have to drop one. Either you drop bliss and you be, or you drop your ego and let bliss be. It is your choice. And that's why I go on saying again and again, it is your choice. If you have chosen to be miserable, it is your choice. You come and ask me how to drop the misery. You want to drop the misery without dropping the ego. But that is not possible. And if I say drop the ego, I always see in your eyes as if I am changing the subject. You think you had come to ask how to drop the misery and I am talking something else. I am saying drop the ego. Of course it looks as if it is something else. Mullah Nasruddin was sitting with a beautiful woman in a full moon night, talking great things. He was getting very, very romantic. But the women are very earthly, earthbound, very practical. When Mullah was getting really too high, the woman said, "Mullah, your love is okay, but will you marry me?" Mullah said, "Listen, don't change the subject. That I have watched many times in your eyes. You bring one problem, I start talking about something else. That only appears on the surface that it is something else. To me, that is the cause. You want to drop the misery, but you don't want to drop the ego. And misery cannot be dropped. Misery is the shadow of the ego. Only the ego can be dropped. Dropping the ego, misery disappears. That seems to be too much price to pay." You say, "We will think. I will think over it." You are not really interested in dropping the misery. If you are really interested, then seeing the fact, you will drop the ego immediately. Sigmund Freud has said that man is naturally miserable. I don't believe in it, but about 99% people, he is right. I cannot deny that. Freud says that there is no hope for man. He is basically miserable. His misery cannot be transformed. He cannot be made happy. The demands are impossible. That's what he means. He demands impossibles. He wants to have a great ego and he wants to be happy. It is as if you want the full sun, no clouds, and still you want the coolness of the dark night, the silence of the dark night, and you want the full sun in the sky. You want it sunny. Now you are demanding impossibles. This is not possible. You can only pretend. That's what people go on doing. You can pretend. You can sit on the beach on a sunny day and keep your eyes closed. This is a pretension. If you keep your eyes closed, you create a darkness inside. You have both the night and the day. But this is a pretension. It is really day. The night is just a false illusion you have created by closing your eyes. The impossibles cannot be done. And the sane man always looks into his life whether he is trying to do the impossibles. The moment he sees that he is trying to do something which cannot be done in the very nature of things, he drops that. That project is immediately dropped. This I call sanity. Insane people are those who go on fighting, not looking at the phenomenon at all. As if you are trying to make a square circle. You can go on trying, but it will never happen. Because a circle is a circle and can never be a square. And a square is a square and can never be a circle. Now you can go on trying. You will be a failure. The whole humanity is a failure, trying to do the impossible. And you say, I hate fighting myself. Now that again is a fight, hate. First you fight, that is wrong, then you do the second wrong, even deeper. Then you fight against fight because you hate. I am teaching acceptance, tathata. I am teaching you a total acceptance of life as it is. Everything included in it. Now, again you will see that there is some difficulty. For example, you will see that I go on fighting, should I accept this too? I say yes. Only by accepting it, it will disappear. Through acceptance, things change. You should accept everything, even the fight. What can you do if you are fighting and pushing the river? You will be creating another problem. If I say, don't fight, then you will start fighting your fight. That will go even more subtle. It will be on a deeper level, but fight will remain. When I say drop fighting, I am not saying start fighting against fight. I am saying accept. If you feel like pushing the river, push. Don't create a new fight against it. Go on pushing, just seeing the whole nonsense of it. That it is stupid. What I am doing is stupid. The river cannot be pushed back. Go on pushing and go on watching and accept it. In that acceptance, in that awareness, one day suddenly you will find your hands have stopped. Not that you have stopped them. If you stop them, then you missed. Then it has been again a fight of stopping. First you were fighting with the river, then you started fighting with your fighting. And you are somehow holding your hands so that they don't start pushing the river again. This will not be a very beautiful state. It will be tense. There will be anguish. And you will be holding yourself. You will not be flowing. You will not be streaming with joy. You will be repressing. And any moment, any opportunity, and you will again start pushing the river. How long you can repress the desire? So listen to me. Listen very meditatively. If you are pushing the river, I am not saying stop it. I am simply saying by pushing the river, nothing is achieved. Listen to it. Let this sink in your heart. And if you feel like pushing because of old habits, for many lives you have been pushing, go on pushing, but go on seeing the fact that this is stupid, that you are being stupid. Don't pull away from it. Don't try to control yourself. Let it happen. But with the vision that it is stupid, that it is meaningless, that nothing is going to come out of it, with no expectation, waiting for frustration, knowing perfectly well that frustration is coming, that I am wasting my energy, but it is because of old habits. Go on. Don't pull back. And one day you will see, hands are getting slower and slower. You are not pushing as hard as you used to. And in a clear vision someday, when you are transparent, you will see the whole absurdity. Seen, there is transformation. Once seen totally, hands simply stop. Not that you stop them. They stop on their own accord. And when they stop on their own accord, there is great grace. There is great beauty. The third question. You have convinced me. Before any question arises, before any answer can be given, I believe you happily. The question is from Yoga Puja. It is not a question at all. Just she wants to share with me. I am happy, Puja. Just change one word in your mind. Don't call it conviction. Call it conversion. That's what really you mean. You have used the wrong word, that's all. Conviction is logical, intellectual, of the mind. It does not go very deep. And behind each conviction, doubt persists. And conviction does not change anybody. It is a mind thing. How can it change your totality? And conviction is borrowed. I am being very logical about something, and you become convinced. But it is I am being very logical about something. My logic appeals to you. You cannot argue against it. Hence conviction. Conviction is borrowed. It is almost we get from others. You become a Christian, a convinced Christian because your parents were Christians. Or a convinced Hindu, a staunch Hindu, a mad Hindu because your parents were Hindus, and so on and so forth. I have heard a Sunday school teacher suddenly stopped reading a passage in the Bible and asked her pupils, "Why do you believe in God?" She got a variety of answers. Some full of simple faith, others obviously insincere. The one that stopped her cold came from the son of one of Chicago's best known ministers. He frowned and answered, "I guess it just runs in our family." That's how you get your convictions. with me, let there be conversion, not conviction. I am not interested in convincing you about anything. Truth is, it needs no conviction. Either you know it or you don't know it. It needs no belief, and belief don't help in any way. What you need is not conviction. You need conversion. Conversion of the heart. A 180 degree turn. A total change of your vision. The change of your plane. From another vantage point, you start looking at life. That is not conviction. That is conversion. Not that your idea has changed, but you have changed. And that's exactly what puja means. She has only used a wrong word. She says, you have convinced me. Before any question arises, before any answer can be given, I believe you. Again, she is using a wrong word, belief. But they are related. If you think it is a conviction, then you will think it is because you have started believing in me. If you think it is a conversion, then it will not be belief, it will be trust. Belief is in what I say. Trust is in what I am. They are diametrically opposite. But my feeling about puja is that she has only used wrong words. Otherwise, she exactly means that. Good, I am happy. If you listen to me from the heart, this is going to happen to everybody. If you listen to me, not with any motive to go anywhere, to achieve anything, but just for the sheer joy of listening it, as one listens music, or as one listens the sound of a waterfall, or this cuckoo. When you listen to me for no motive at all, but just to be here with me, conversion is going to happen. Transformation is going to happen. My flame is going to jump into you and lit your unlit candles. The fourth question, Bhagwan, just when the ashram seems to be coming together, we will be moving. Is it your intention that we should be living on a perpetual building site? Precisely. The fifth question, is there any necessity for everybody to have a religion of one kind or other? Yes. Everybody ought to have a religion of one kind or other. You owe to it to yourself to know what church you are staying away from. Otherwise you will feel very miserable. You will miss. I have heard. Nurse, what church do you belong to? Patient, none. Nurse, well, what church do you go to when you go? Patient, if you must know, the church which I stay away from the most of the time when I don't go is the Baptist. are sinking had been shipwrecked for 20 years on a desert island. When finally he was rescued by a passing ship, "What did you do to keep busy all those years?" asked the captain of the rescue vessel. "I went into the building business," replied Simkin. Whereupon he took the captain to a corner of the island and showed him a beautiful synagogue. "That's incredible," said the sailing master. "That's nothing," said Simkin. This time he led him to the opposite side of the island and displayed another magnificently constructed house of worship. "I don't understand," said the captain. "You are the only person on the island. Why did you need two synagogues?" "This one I belong to," explained Simkin. "But the other one, I would not set foot inside if they paid me." These are your ways to define yourself. These are the ways of the ego to define itself. You are a Hindu, are a Mohammedan, are a Buddhist. You are Indian, German, or Italian. You are a Catholic, are a Protestant. These are ways to define yourself, who you are. In fact, a religious person need not have any religion. A religious person is religionless. A religious person has a quality of religiousness, certainly. But that quality is so indefinable. It is more like a poetry around him, more like a radiance. Yes, in his actions you will see a grace. In his life you will see gratitude. In his behavior you will see compassion. But not that he is Hindu or Mohammedan or Christian. These are very mediocre ways to become religious. These are not the real ways to become religious. Religion is basically an art, how to live and how to die, how to live in joy and how to die in joy, how to live gracefully and how to die gracefully, how to make your whole life, death included in it, a celebration. Religion has nothing to do with the Bible, the Gita, the Quran. Religion has something to do with the alchemical transformation of your being. So whenever you will find a really religious person, you will not find him Hindu, Mohammedan, Christian, Jew. You will simply find him an unknown quality present in him, which defines him. But this definition is not of the ego. This definition is just of his lifestyle. Yes, around Jesus you will find a quality of religiousness. So you will find around Buddha, or around Muhammad, or around Nanak, you will find a quality of religiousness. But you will have to watch. You will have to have a certain vision to see it. It happened in Nanak's life. He came to visit a town. And there were many saints in the town. Mohammedan, Jainas, Buddhists, Hindus. The town was too full of the saints. And of course, when there are too many saints, there were much conflict, controversy. And a new prophet is coming. So the old saints thought, "This is too much. We are already overcrowded here. So they called the conference and they sent a message to Nanak. He was staying just outside the town. The message was that it is too crowded. We are already too many here. Already business is not much, because clients are few and sins are many. You please go somewhere else. And they knew that Nanak's name had reached, his fame has reached. If he comes, even those few clients that they can divide amongst themselves will be gone. So they did a beautiful thing. They thought how to send the message so Nanak does not feel offended. They were worried he will feel offended because it is offensive. Who you are to prevent Nanak? But they were cunning people. They searched in the scriptures and found out a way. They sent a cup full of oil. Not even a single drop can be put more. Almost overflowing, on the verge. As a symbol that this town is so full of sins and religions that not a single drop can be accepted more. No space is there. Nanak was sitting near a well under a tree with his disciples, and the disciple was singing a song, playing on his instrument. These people came with the cup. Nanak looked at them, understood the message, took away a flower by the side of the well, a wild flower, floated the flower on the cup in the oil. The flower was so small, it simply floated on it. It didn't take any space. No oil came out of it. And said to them, go back and give this cup to the people who have sent you to me. The disciple was puzzled. He said, I don't understand what is transpiring between you and these people. First, this cup was very mysterious. What exactly they meant? Nanak said, they mean that here we are too many and there is no space. But Nanak said, a religious man needs no space. That's my answer. I will not be fighting with anybody. I will not be in any competition with anybody. A religious man needs no space. A religious man is not a businessman. They need not be afraid of me. I will be here just like this flower floating on top of the full cup. And I will be only here just like the flower. One day I will be here, tomorrow I will be gone. They need not be worried about me. Now this is religiousness, non-competitiveness, no conflict with anybody, no aggression. And one knows that one is just here for a few moments. It is a caravansarai. Overnight stay and by the morning we are gone. Just like flowers. A religious person has nothing to do with organized religion, but he has something to do with the inner poetry, the poetry of life. He has something to do with the inner dance. He has a dancing energy. He is in deep romance with life. He is in romantic love with life. He is immensely grateful for each moment of joy that God goes on giving And we are not even worthy. We don't deserve it. We have not earned it. It is a gift. You ask, is there any necessity for everybody to have a religion of one kind or another? And the second thing, there are not two kinds of religion. Religiousness is one. Maybe formulations differ. It is just like you make your house in one way, another makes in another way, and the third one has chosen a third architect to design his house. But the inner thing is one, that you need a shelter, that you need a roof. Somebody cooks in the Indian style, somebody in a Chinese style, and somebody in some other style. But the real thing is hunger, that you need food, that you need nourishment. So these so-called religions are nothing but different styles of nourishment. You can choose, but that is not important. The important thing is nourishment, shelter. The important thing is to have refuge in God. Surrender. What Sufis call Islam. And commitment. What Sufis call Iman. And a transformation in your life through that trust. What Sufis call Ihsan. The sixth question. 4 years ago, I had a reading which said that my blood disease was gone due to the Guru's blessings. When I told you, you said, from the day you took sannyas, your cancer was gone. I remember feeling that you are saying that might have been a design and not a real fact. I always accepted that your truths may not be facts. Did I miss because of this? First thing, truth has no obligation to be a fact. Fact is a lower phenomenon. Truth is a higher phenomenon. Sometimes the truth may be factual, sometimes not. The fact cannot be decisive about it. There are higher experiences in life which cannot be contained by facts. But I can understand. The question is from Chinmaya. The Western mind is too much addicted with facts. Anything that is factual seems to be real. And anything that is not factual necessarily seems to be unreal. This is a Western obsession. Truth sometimes is factual, sometimes is not. That's why I say truth has no obligation to be factual. Because of this, the Western scientific mind cannot accept human soul, because it is not sexual. The body is sexual. The soul is truth, not fact. And the way facts are known, truths are not known. The approach has to be completely different. For example, you see a rose. The beauty is truth, but not facts. You cannot prove it. There is no way to prove the beauty of the rose. You can prove its color. You can prove its weight. You can prove its chemistry. But you cannot prove its aesthetics. But there is something even higher than beauty. Tennyson is reported to have said that if I can understand a single flower, root and all, I would have understood the whole existence. Because the flower contains something which is more than the facts. It's a hidden reality. It's intrinsic reality. But that reality cannot be approached by grass instruments of scientific experimentation. Truth has to be approached in a different way, through meditation, through love. Chinmaya says, 4 years ago I had a reading which said that my blood disease was gone due to the Guru's blessings. When I told you, you said from the day you took sannyas, your cancer was gone. Cancer is basically a psychological disease. Basically, not physical, but of the mind. When the mind becomes very tense, so tense that it is intolerable, it starts affecting the body tissues. That's why cancer exists only when civilization becomes very, very sophisticated. In the primitive societies, you cannot find cancer. People are not so sophisticated. Higher, by higher I mean complicated, sophisticated, complex society is, more cancer will happen. So when I said to Chinmaya, from the day you took sannyas, your cancer was gone, I was saying many things. Sannyas is dropping the mind. Sannyas is exactly that you surrender the mind. Sannyas means you surrender all your complexities, obsessions, neuroses. Sannyas means now you are ready to live a simple, ordinary life. Sannyas means that you are ready to become primal, innocent, childlike. Cancer has to disappear. Cancer can exist only in a certain neurotic state of mind. If the mind relaxes, sooner or later the body will follow and will relax. It is because of this fact that scientific investigation has not been yet able to find cure for the cancer. It is almost impossible to find cure for the cancer. And the day they will find cure for the cancer, they will create even more dangerous diseases in the world. Because cure will mean depression. The day they can find strong drugs to repress cancer, then some other disease will erupt. That poison will start flowing through some other channels. That's how it has happened down the ages. Simple diseases were cured and difficult diseases came into being. You cure one disease, another disease comes in. And the second one is more complex than the first. The first was a natural reaction of the body. The second is an unnatural, abnormal reaction of the body. You repress the second and the third will come, and third will be even more difficult to tackle with, and so on and so forth. Now cancer is at the top. If cancer is repressed, then even more difficult diseases will erupt in human body and human mind. When I said to Chinmaya, from the day you took sannyas, your cancer was gone, I was not talking about any facts. I was indicating about a truth. And if he had trusted me, it was gone. But a subtle doubt must have persisted in him. He says, I remember feeling that your saying that might have been a design and not a real fact. Which a design is higher than a fact. A fact is a very ordinary thing. A design is a higher thing. But we believe in the very, very lower reality. That's why we go on missing the higher reality. Yes, the color of the flower is a fact, and the chemistry is a fact, but the poetry, but the beauty, the joy that the flower creates in you when you look at it, the awe that suddenly arises in your heart, that is not factual, true. But is it untrue because it is not factual? No. It is a higher truth. The higher need not agree with the lower. The lower has to agree with the higher. This is the Eastern approach. The Western approach is to reduce the higher to the lower. The Eastern approach is to raise the higher, to raise the lower to the higher. For example, if you go and watch a lotus growing, it grows out of dirty mud. The Western approach is, if you sow the lotus to the Western thinker, he will say, what it is? Nothing but mud. Nothing but is the approach. Nothing but mud. And he is factual. About that, there is no doubt. It has come out of dirty mud. It's stinking mud. So he says, what is the source of it? Reduce it to the source. Go to the cause. The cause is the dirty mud. So this lotus is nothing but dirty mud. That's why Freud goes on saying that the experience of samadhi is nothing but sex. The experience of samadhi is a lotus blooming. But he goes to the source. And he is true. True in the sense he is sexual. He cannot be refuted on that ground. All your so-called Mahatmas together cannot refute him on that ground. He is valid as far as sexuality is concerned. Because the samadhi is a flowering of the sexual energy. But in the same way as mud becomes lotus, can you really call the lotus just mud, nothing else? Is not it something utterly new, coming out of the mud? Certainly, but can you reduce it back to the mud? The Eastern approach is, we say that even the mud is respectable because some rose may be hidden in it, some lotus may be hidden in it. In the Western mind, the lotus becomes condemned because it comes out of mud. In the Eastern mind, the mud becomes sacred because it produces lotus. We look to the ultimate. We don't go backwards. We go forwards. We see the ultimate possibility. West goes on seeing the source. We see the goal. We are not worried from where it comes. We are more worried where it is going. The potential. The ultimately potential. That's what truth is. In the Western mind, man becomes body. In the Eastern mind, man becomes God. In the Western mind, the world is just materialist. there exists nothing else but matter. In the Eastern mind, there exists nothing but God, but soul. Matter is also soul asleep. Matter is also soul potential. One day it will become soul. These are different visions. And if you have to choose, choose the Eastern vision, because it is reverence for life, reverence for truth. Fact is an ordinary thing. Don't be too much entangled by the facts. You say, I remember feeling that you are saying that might have been a design. When Chinmaya says might have been a design, he is saying might have been a lie. A design is neither truth nor a lie. A design is just a creative device. If you trust in it, it works. If you don't trust in it, it doesn't work. It is up to you. You can miss. If the idea arises in you that it may be just a design, what are you saying? You are saying it may be just a lie. That very idea will be enough to become a barrier. The bridge is broken. Remember, a design is higher than facts. It is lower than truth, but higher than facts. It leads you from the fact to the truth. It is a bridge between the two. It is neither factual nor true, but it leads. Listen to this. A Bavarian farmer wanted to sell his pig in the nearby Switzerland to get a better price. To avoid paying customs, he dressed the pig in his black suit with sunglasses and a hat and put it in the back of his Mercedes. At the border, the custom officer looked inside the car, then gave the farmer the sign to drive on. He turned around to his friend and exploded into laughter. "What happened?" asked his friend. "There was a guy sitting inside," he answered with tears of laughter, "who looked exactly like a pig." This is a design. It works. The whole point is that it worked. Whether it is a lie or truth does not matter. It is not factual that is true. It is not true that too is true. It is just in between. And to be with a master is to be available to his designs. The last question. You use sometimes the word accident or accidental to describe an event. Are there any accidents in life in reality? In reality, there are only accidents and accidents and nothing else. The factual world is the world of cause and effect. The world of truth is the world of freedom. Freedom means causes don't work at all. Freedom means now everything is accidental. Now everything is possible. Nothing is impossible in the world of reality. When you become enlightened, since that moment, everything becomes possible. Now no cause and effects have any hold on you. But I understand your question that comes again from the same ideology, that how anything can be accidental. The world is confined to cause and effect. Everything can be reduced to cause and effect. Nothing happens as a miracle. That is the scientific approach. That's why men like B.F. Skinner, R. Pavlov, and other behaviorists, they go on saying that the idea of freedom is just stupid. There is no freedom. Man has no freedom because everything is predestined by cause and effect. If Skinner is right, then Buddha cannot be right. If Skinner is right, then the whole heritage of religion is wrong. Then everything is predestined by cause and effect. You do a certain thing just as a machine does it. You don't have any freedom. And about 99% people, these people are right. If they watch ordinary people, they will find every support for them. And that's how they have come to these conclusions. When I am talking, there is a meeting of two different dimensions. You live in the world which is determined by a cause and effect. I live in the world which is of freedom. When I look at you, I will talk about cause and effect. When I look into myself, I talk about freedom. In the real world, in the world of truth, all is absolute freedom. Nothing is predetermined. And that's the beauty of it. That's why in India we have called it moksha. Moksha means freedom, absolute freedom. Man is neither naturally good nor bad. He is free and he becomes good or bad according as he accepts his freedom or denies it. To exist is to be obliged to be free. What is left to us in the way in which we will be free, and in the last result there are just these two ways. To use our freedom against freedom or to use it for freedom. Existence is the self's possibility to be or not to be itself. This is an existentialist statement. I agree with it. Man is freedom. Not only that man is free, but man is freedom. Freedom is man's essential course, and that is man's dignity. Animals are less free. Trees are even more less free. Rocks even more less free. That's how we decide who is more evolved, according to freedom. A rock is not very much free. A tree is a little more free. It can grow according to some inner vision. It can feel sad or happy. It can make some efforts. It can struggle, compete. It cannot leave its ground. That way it is unfree, it is rooted. Animals are a little more free. They can move. Physically they can move. Birds are even a little more free. They can fly into the faraway sky. Man is even more free. Not only physically he can move mentally. His mind can move. And a Buddha is total freedom, because not only his mind, but his soul is free. Freedom goes on growing, layer upon layer. It becomes more and more. When freedom becomes absolute, you have arrived home. You ask me, you use sometimes the word accident or accidental to describe an event. Are there any accidents in life in reality? Meditate over on this joke. One early morning in heaven, three men arrived at the same time. Saint Peter was surprised, as hardly anybody came at this time. So he asked the first, "How come?" "Well," he said, "I came back home from a journey and found a man's coat hanging up and shoes lying around and my wife naked in bed looking very happy. So I searched for the man but could not find anybody and got so furious that I smashed the TV and threw the fridge out of the window, then took a gun and killed myself." "And you?" Saint Peter asked the second. "Well, I was making love to my secretary when she said suddenly, 'Ah, my husband,' so I jumped in the fridge to hide. But then the fellow threw the fridge out from the third floor, so I am here." "I don't know," said the third. "I was just waiting for my bus in the morning, when suddenly a fridge came out of the blue and brought me here." Enough for today.